So we're continuing today our series on stress, and this morning we're looking at anointed and stressed. Just going to reread those first five verses. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he'd killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a message to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there, while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree and sat down under it and prayed that he might die. "I've had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under a tree and fell asleep. Anointed and stressed. Have you ever found that when you've got something really difficult and demanding to achieve, maybe you train for it, you study, you practice, you endure, you hold the course and grit your teeth, and eventually you get there. And when you've achieved it, when you've got there, when you've succeeded, there at that moment there comes a kind of an elation that comes from success and an achievement. Yes! I've done it! And then often there's a sense of relief that comes after that. Phew! Yes, I've done it. And then, sometimes, well, there comes quite a vulnerable time, actually. Quite a vulnerable time. A study has shown that many ministers, apparently, are more susceptible to having low days on Monday than any other day of the week. We're trying to unpack that, and it must be because the week before has been a build-up of prayer and study and expectation and faith for what God's going to do on the Sunday. Then you get to the Sunday and God does it all and a whole lot more. Then comes Monday. Monday, the kind of anti-climax, the when it's all happened, the when it's all finished, the what next? And someone once said that Monday is traditionally, of course, the day when all the emails come in from the people who haven't enjoyed the Sunday. And although Jezebel didn't have a computer, she did send a very strong communication to Elijah about the last worship service that he did. You see, what Elijah had been up to was he'd taken a worship service on Mount Carmel. And at that service, basically, the God that Jezebel and all the people like her worshipped was brought down to nothing and defeated and humbled. And all the priests were killed. So you see, this reading, it contains and starts with a communication, especially from Jezebel to Elijah about the worship service. And proceed, it comes to something like this. "Elijah, you're a dead man." That's basically what she's saying. "Elijah, you are a dead man." Now, it comes just after the most amazing victory, the most spectacular showing of God's power that Elijah had ever encountered in his life. Isn't that amazing? You get this incredible victory of God, public and open and dynamic and exciting, followed by this single communication from this queen. Now you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that with the great Elijah, the anointed prophet of God, you'd have thought that in the light of that victory and that amazing demonstration of God's power, he'd have actually stood his ground. So what? He'd have stood his ground confidently and unafraid. But as you know from the rest of the reading, that's exactly what doesn't happen. Elijah, you're a dead man. What happens? Totally struck down with fear. Basically, Elijah ran away as quickly and as far as he possibly could. So you see, anointed people can get stressed. Now this morning I'm going to look at five mistakes that I think that Elijah made in the course of this chapter. Five mistakes. And the first one is, Elijah didn't take the thought captive and look at the evidence. Just going back to last week and some of the things that we looked at in general about stress and how Jesus has given us the power to take a thought captive, not let it affect us, and then bring it before him and look at it through Jesus' tinted spectacles. Elijah didn't do that. The thought came in and it says Elijah was afraid and he ran for his life. Instead of taking it to God in prayer, he did a runner. What he really did actually was to take God out of the equation, isn't it? He took God out of that equation. He lost his godly perspective. Fear overshadowed faith. That's the first mistake that Elijah made. He didn't take that thought, that communication, that situation. He didn't take it captive and bring it under Christ and look at it through the eyes of faith. He lost his perspective. The second mistake that Elijah made, I think, was he separated himself from strengthening and encouraging relationships. He cut himself off from fellowship. Let me explain what I mean by that. It says in verse 3, when he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he went himself alone a day's journey into the desert. With that fear, with that worry, with that issue, he went alone. And actually, I've seen that in people's lives over the years of ministering in churches. Some people, when they're really facing something difficult, whether it's sin or difficult life circumstances or doubt, or just when they're just struggling, very often, when their faith is stretched and the doubts set in, they withdraw. They withdraw from fellowship, which is exactly the opposite thing, actually, that we need to do. They cut themselves off. I've always thought that one of the devil's best strategies against Christians is to isolate and destroy. If God can get you close to him, clinging on to him and to fellowship, there's a great strength in that. But if Satan can pull you out of that, so you're by yourself, you are very vulnerable. You're very vulnerable. So think about that. The next time that your faith is under fire or you're in a difficult place and you're tempted to withdraw, that's the wrong thing to do. That makes us ever so vulnerable. And that's what Elijah did. He left his companion and he went on in the desert alone. Firstly, he didn't take that situation, that thought captive and bring it to God in faith and pray about it. Secondly, he cut himself off. He isolated himself. Thirdly, Elijah, I don't think he planned far enough ahead. I mean, everyone plans and prepares for the moment of exertion, don't they? The showdown, the fight, the race. But very few people plan for what immediately follows. They may have planned for the big event. They may even plan for the next thing. But that bit in the middle very often isn't prayed through and isn't planned through in people's lives. If you think about it logically, after the showdown on the mountain and killing all the priests of Baal, what did he think that Jezebel was going to say and Ahab? What did he think they were going to say? Oh, thanks for humiliating us, Elijah. But he hadn't planned that through, and he hadn't prayed that through, and he hadn't prepared himself for that. And so we need to be a people who are prepared in life. We need to plan and pray ahead, but not just far ahead or the bit that we're just facing where the effort and stuff comes, but the bit in the middle. That's the bit that gets left out in our lives. So everybody is going to be praying for their exams this summer. All students are going to be praying for their exams. Lord, help me to concentrate, help me to revise. Lord, make the right questions come up, give me the right answers. Everyone's going to pray for that. And then everyone's going to be praying for, oh, and Lord, help me to find the right job. Help me when I go back home to my own country. But no one's going to be praying for the middle bit in their lives. Lord, for the 2 weeks after I've finished my exams, I just pray that you'd give me a vision for that. I pray that you'd strengthen me to deal with that. That's the bit that gets left out. So let's not leave those bits out, those little tiny middle bits that seem to be of no consequence, because that's often the time when the enemy can come in and thump us, because we're not prepared. Elijah didn't take the thought captive. He separated himself from strengthening and encouraging relationships and fellowship. He didn't plan for that middle bit, that next bit. He didn't plan far enough ahead. And I put it to you, fourthly, that he hadn't paced himself. You see, for years, Elijah had lived on the edge, if you like, with no let-up at all. He was wanted and he was hunted. In the king's eyes, he was public enemy number one, roughing it in the wilderness. So what does he do when he's running away? Verse 4 says, while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. You know, Mount Carmel must have been quite an emotional and exhausting time. The showdown with all the prophets of Baal, all the stuff that would have taken out of him. What does he do? He goes and runs in the desert for a day. I mean, you know, I couldn't run for an hour from this church, but to run after all that for a whole day in the desert, that's totally draining. He didn't pace himself. He didn't look after himself. Nowhere does it say it's really, really spiritual to drive yourself so hard until you drop for the Lord. It doesn't say that's not a spiritual thing to do. That's not taking responsibility for ourselves and for feeding and replenishing ourselves, which is part of stewardship of our bodies and who we are as people. And he just went from one thing to the other. And so he collapsed. He pushed himself and he pushed himself, letting the pressure drive him. Now, there's an ancient Greek saying which went something like this: you will break the bow if you keep it always bent. If you're always constantly under pressure with no let up, you will break. At some point, you will surely break. That's what I was on about last week with this stressed out lifestyle of constant pressure. He didn't pace himself. And lastly, what happened? Well, lastly, Elijah disappeared into a pool of self-pity. It says he came to a broom tree, sat down under it and prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Guilty, victim mentality, self-condemnation. All those things take root in a pool of self-pity. And I have got an aside actually for us this morning. Take my life, I'm no better than my ancestors. Who had told him he needed to be better than his ancestors? I can't find it. I can't find the bit where God says, Elijah, go forth and be better than your ancestors. That's my number one priority for you, that you paste your ancestors with your success record. Where's that come from? We put a lot of stuff on ourselves about how we've got to be and what we've got to do that actually isn't necessarily put on us by God. So finally, he comes to the very end of what he can do, the end of what he can take. Petrol tank's empty, that's it. So what does God do in that situation? What does the Lord do? Well, he comes to Elijah and says, Elijah, get up, man. Man up. Elijah, get up and fight. Doesn't do that. Nor does he say, Elijah, now's not the time for sleeping. Run some more. Doesn't say that, does he? Elijah, I'm really disappointed with you. And you're no good. You're not as good as your ancestors were. They'd have never done it. It's not there, is it? Elijah, where's your faith? It's not there. It's not there. I just find this whole chapter astounding as to what God actually does. First of all, the Lord lets him rest. Verse 5, then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. And then it comes, and I just found it kind of moving but funny and all kinds of things when you think about it. Because what the Lord actually does is he bakes him a cake. Whatever way you look at it, that's what has happened here. God bakes him a cake. All at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was a what? Was a cake. A cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jug of water. God baked him a cake. And then said to him, now, get up. No, what happens next? He ate and drank and then lay down again. And what does God do? Go on, I'll give you a clue. What does God do next? More cake! More cake! This is my kind of God. More cake. God bakes him another cake. A cake served by an angel. Angel cake. I don't know. Do you know, some people say, and I'm not doing a Jeremy Clarkson impersonation here, some people say that when the Old Testament refers to the angel, that may be possibly referring to Jesus. Because, of course, Jesus was active in the Old Testament, wasn't he? He was there at creation. Isn't that amazing to think it may actually have been Jesus who baked Elijah a cake? Just a thought. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. God knows that sometimes the stuff that we put on ourselves is too much for us. He didn't put any of that on Elijah. Elijah put all of that, all the running away, the going in the desert. He did that all to himself. I've got to be better than my ancestors. This is all something that Elijah put on himself. I wonder if we sometimes put things on ourselves about how we think we should be performing for God. And then get fed up and depressed when we don't match our own objectives. Well, it was then and only then, after the second cake, having been ministered to by God, that Elijah then continues on his journey. And I'm going to slightly labour that point, being ministered to by God, because it's just so important. I wonder, when was the last time that you truly stopped, and allowed the Lord to minister to you? When is the last time you truly stopped and allowed the Lord to minister to you? And to give you a new revelation of who he is. I mean, there are lots of different ways to be ministered to. A lot of people like to just get by themselves and be ministered to by God. But we do have this little ministry zone there that we made about 18 months ago. And it's not used very much, you know. If you consider that God is here and he knows what we're going through and he's desperate to minister to us, there are not many people at the end of the service who actually go up to be ministered to by God. But it's there. That's not the only way, but it is there, and it is a way. So I just present that to you again with the God who wants to minister to us and meet us at our point of need, no matter how low we've got, how stressed we are. He wants to meet us, and he can bring us out of that. He can do it. Verse 8, so Elijah got up, he ate, he drank, strengthened by the food, strength having been ministered to by God, strengthened by the food, he travelled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God, where he went into a cave and spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, put your prophets to death with the sword, and I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. There, in the cave of despondency, Elijah thinks that he's alone. But nothing could be further from the truth. We're never alone. The Lord always has his people. And if you cheat and skip down to verse 18, God's got thousands of faithful followers in reserve. But Elijah's cut himself off from all that. Lord, I'm the only one left. Elijah, you're not. I'm here, I'm God, and I'm in charge. I've got 7,000 over there. You are not the only one left. And nor are you ever by yourselves. Nor are you ever by yourselves. His resources sometimes astound us when we begin to realize what they really are. I do find it interesting, though, in this passage, I don't know if you noticed it, but God repeats the question twice to Elijah. After you get him appearing in front of the cave, he actually does the same question again. What are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah gives the same answer. And I've been thinking about that this week. Why is the question repeated? Why is the answer from Elijah given again? What's that all about? Why is that in the Bible? And I've come to this conclusion. God says to Elijah, what are you doing here? And Elijah says, oh, I'm the only one. Oh, I'm going to fail. Then you get the God passing in front of the cave, revealing himself in a new and a fresh way. So I think that the first time round, God reveals himself to Elijah. And the second time round, God reveals his plan to Elijah. Now I want you to do this. Okay, so we get the first question and dialogue, God reveals himself. The second question and dialogue, God then reveals his plan. And that sounds like the right, then there's not a third, there needn't be a third time. It's all done. When you know who God is, and then you know what he wants you to do. That's all we need to know. And that is the right way round. I think we've got to encounter the Lord first, and then follow his plan. So there's no point in me going to Grenoble with a wonderful plan that I've hatched up between now and then of how we're going to fill the church out and reach out. No, the first thing has to be to encounter God afresh for there and when I'm there. That's got to be the first time round. And it's so easy for us as individuals and as churches to come up with our own plans and then take them to God for a blessing. You ever come across that in your own life or in church life? Oh, I'm going to come up with a good idea, a plan, and then, oh, let's take that to the Lord now. And I just think that's not the best way around. The best way around is to encounter the Lord afresh and then hear from him about who he is and what his plan is. And then it's pre-blessed. Just a thought. So we've got to look for a revelation of God and a revelation from God, because surely it all hinges on him. So the Lord, he's given Elijah rest and refreshment, a new vision of him. Not just the rocks, but I was thinking about that as well, you know, the kind of the different things that happen and that God is in the gentle whisper. It's a lovely poetic piece, and we've written hymns about it, but why did God do that? I mean, didn't Elijah need to have a bit more kind of thunder-splitting God so he can go back and duff up Jezebel? Isn't that what he would have needed? What is all this stuff with the gentle whisper. Have you ever wondered that? What's all that about? And why did God choose to reveal himself in this quiet, gentle whisper? And I think that it's because it's not just about the rock-splintering God who triumphed at Carmel over the prophets of Baal. It's also about a gentle, caring Heavenly Father who blows over us his words of love and encouragement. It's another side of God that we need to know and we need to encounter. And he gives Elijah significance. He tells him, now we're going to do this. His ongoing plan. And God even gives him a new companion to go with him. He's no longer to be alone. This chapter finishes with him going and finding a new companion to encourage him and to be with him. So can you see how God has led Elijah in this chapter according to where he is and to what he needs to bring him on to where he should be? So that just leaves us to the matter of you and me and what God might be saying to us. Perhaps this morning you are in the middle of a Mount Carmel experience. Perhaps you're in the middle of seeing God do amazing things. That's a great place to be. Perhaps, on the other hand, you're running away. Perhaps you're afraid. Maybe you're disillusioned or overwhelmed by what you perceive to be the odds against you and what you want to do. That's certainly where Elijah was. Perhaps you're exhausted, just tired. Perhaps you are feeling stressed or feeling low. Maybe you're feeling alone. Maybe you can't see the next stage of God's plan for your life. Maybe it's none of those and something completely different. Maybe it is. This morning, I think the Lord wants us all to know that wherever we are, wherever you are, wherever I am, firstly, he understands. He understands. And secondly, he cares. He is the Lord who met Elijah where he was and led him to a better place. And this morning, the news is this, and it's very good news. He wants to do exactly the same for you and for me. Amen.